transition in North Korea, a Muslim college in California, sexuality in the media, Christopher Hitchens says go ahead and pray, a universe from nothing, and men wearing cosmetics. This is September 9, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. It was 62 years ago today, September 9, 1948, when the government of North Korea was established. The communist regime was established as the People's Democratic Republic of Korea. And from that time, 62 years ago until the present, that dictatorship has been known around the world as the Hermit Kingdom. Now, writing in the Financial Times, Robert Kaplan and Abraham Denmark suggest that there's a transfer of power coming once again in North Korea, and this time it is likely to be the last transfer of one-man rule. Kaplan and Denmark write that the transfer of power from Kim Jong-il, the current dictator, to Kim Jong-un, who is his 20-something son, is likely to be very different than the transfer that brought Kim Jong-il to power in Pyongyang. The reality is that the power structures amongst the elites in North Korea are now very much dispersed. It's not the same nation it was when it was established 62 years ago, nor even when the transition to Kim Jong-il took place just several years ago. The reality is that North Korea is made up of citizens who more and more are aware of the impoverished state of their regime. They are aware of the tyranny that has held power over them, and they are aware that there could be political alternatives. A dictatorship like that in North Korea requires the complicity of various elites. But the reality is now clear that those elites do not hold their allegiance to Kim Jong-un as they did to Kim Jong-il and to his father. Christians looking at this need to have some very important issues in mind. First of all, this is a nation that is amongst those with the least respect for religious liberty. We need to hope and pray that in the transition that takes place, there will be a transition for greater religious liberty and the opportunity for the proclamation of the gospel in North Korea. We also need to be praying, knowing that this is a tinderbox, that indeed North Korea has a very large army, one of the largest standing armies on the planet. It has been now armed with nuclear weapons, and it has menaced the democratic government of South Korea now for six decades. We are looking at a situation that could become a matter of major power importance. It has been noted with great interest that Kim Jong-il made a sudden trip to China just in recent days, where it is assumed he was seeking confirmation of his succession plan of power to Kim Jong-un. We need to pray for the people of South Korea, for their physical needs, for alleviation of their ills and their poverty, and for also the taste of freedom for which they have been yearning. But this is also a reminder to us that there are no guarantees in history. In a fallen world, things can go from bad, indeed, to worse. We need to pray that in this case, in this beleaguered nation, this transfer of power would actually point, one way or another, from bad to better. In California, there's a very interesting news story, and Christians will be hearing this, I think, with a particular kind of interest. There is a Muslim college now to be established, a liberal arts college, that is advertised as the very first of its kind. In Anaheim, California, this was announced, but there is a college to be established in Berkeley to the north. It is Zaytuna College. The organizers say that this is the very first college of its kind. It is going to become, they suggest, the great intellectual powerhouse for Muslims in America. Now, what's really interesting about this, of course, is that the 15 students who are called pioneers in this new study and college are identified as the vanguard of a new form of American-educated Muslims. This particular college, by the way, Zaytuna College, is not precisely a seminary, but it is going to train imams. It's going to be very interesting to see how this comes about. There is a good deal of controversy, as might be expected, about the college, and it will be very interesting to see, even in the liberal environment of Berkeley, California, if this receives a very neighborly response. The numbers are not overwhelming. According to press reports, only 15 full-time students are enrolled in the inaugural class, called by their professors as pioneers. Nevertheless, many of the great universities and colleges we know today started with just this kind of number of students. There's something else here from a Christian perspective that ought to capture our attention. Los Angeles Times reports that Zaytuna College does not have facilities of its own, but is borrowing and renting space from a Baptist seminary. That's right, from the American Baptist Seminary of the West, a liberal institution in Berkeley, California. You know, when you travel throughout much of England and Europe, you'll note churches that have been desacralized, de-Christianized, and turned into mosques. Well, it looks like something very much like that is happening in the United States, where at least some portion of what had been and now is a Baptist seminary affiliated with the American Baptist churches is now going to be the home of the first Muslim liberal arts college in America. It's not exactly an onion dome atop an old church, but it's frighteningly similar. Speaking of frightening, news from the American Academy of Pediatrics ought to have the concern of all parents. The American Academy of Pediatrics is, of course, the major professional organization for specialists in the medical treatment of children and adolescents. The Committee on Public Education of the AAP has released a study entitled Sexuality, Contraception, and the Media. Now, there are a couple of angles to this that I think are of great importance. First, the raw numbers. The numbers of, for instance, sexually suggestive images seen by children and adolescents through the American media are breathtaking. Listen to this. American media are thought to be the most sexually suggestive in the Western Hemisphere. The average American adolescent will view nearly 14,000 sexual references per year. That's a stunning number. 14,000 per adolescent per year in the American media. Now, there are many similar statistics found in this study, and I guess it would make sense that American pediatricians are concerned about the influence of this kind of sexual imagery would have on their young patients. But what should alarm parents not just about the numbers of instances of sexual exposure for their adolescents, but frankly should concern them about the moral judgment of pediatricians, is that the American Academy of Pediatrics seems to be more concerned not about the number of references to sex and the images that children and adolescents see, but the fact that there are not enough references to, you got it, safe sex. The American Academy of Pediatrics is chastising the media for too many images of sex that are not tied to the use of, for instance, a condom and the other things that are defined these days as safe sex. It says something, I think, about the worldview of the American Academy of Pediatrics that they are not castigating the media for the sexual exposure they are giving to American children and adolescents per se, but only for the fact that there is a lack of context and attention to what is called safe sex. The next time you think about safety, you might want to have that in mind in terms of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Many of us have watched with great interest and concern as Christopher Hitchens, one of the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism, was diagnosed with a serious case of cancer. Mr. Hitchens now acknowledges that, to his mind and to the medical practitioners who are treating him, he is basically a dying man. Writing in Vanity Fair, he addresses something that came to the attention of many around the world as soon as Christopher Hitchens was announced to have received this diagnosis. How exactly does one pray for an atheist? And does an atheist wish to be prayed for? And with his usual acerbic tongue and with his very acidic pen, Christopher Hitchens addresses this in an article in Vanity Fair magazine entitled Unanswerable Prayers. As the wording under the headline suggests, what's an atheist to think when thousands of believers, including prominent rabbis and priests, are praying for his survival and salvation while others believe his cancer was divinely inspired and hope that he burns in hell? Well, you can imagine some of the unfortunate things that have been said out there in the blogosphere and in the Twitterverse as persons with very little theological judgment and even less compassion have suggested that they know exactly why Christopher Hitchens has cancer, and they have alleged that it is because of his atheism. Well, there is no doubt that God will judge his atheism, but we have no theological basis for pointing to this particular instance of cancer as the cause. After all, as Christopher Hitchens writes in this column, almost all men get cancer of the prostate if they live long enough. He says it's an undignified thing, but quite evenly distributed among saints and sinners, believers and unbelievers. If you believe that God awards the appropriate cancers, you must also account for the number of infants who contact leukemia. Devout persons have died young and in pain. Bertrand Russell and Voltaire, those were infamous atheists by contrast, remained spry until the end. The point of Christopher Hitchens is that his cancer, to his mind, appears entirely arbitrary. Well, when you start looking at Christopher Hitchens and the reality of his atheism and now the reality of his terminal cancer, the issue of prayer does come immediately to mind, and he addresses that very directly in this article. At the end of the article, he suggests that it just might be okay for people to pray for him, but he doesn't hold out any hope for the efficacy of their prayers. He says, "Suppose I ditch the principles I have for a lifetime in hope of gaining favor at the last minute." He suggests that this he will not do, both for his own integrity as he sees it, and indeed because he genuinely does not believe in God. He says this, "I don't mean to be churlish about any kind intentions, but when September the 20th comes, that's the day that many have marked as a Pray for Christopher Hitchens Day, please don't trouble deaf heaven with your bootless cries." And then he says, "Unless, of course, it makes you feel better." A very sad commentary from a very sad man. A man whose worldview cannot even acknowledge the possibility that this cancer might be something to get his attention. And whether or not you argue about the causality of his cancer, the reality is that here is a man whose attention has not been gained by the experience of receiving a diagnosis of a terminal cancer. This is a man we must now judge whose atheism is entirely authentic, as much as it is tragic. Well, not only on September the 20th, but on other days, I'll tell you, I'm praying for Christopher Hitchens. Am I praying for his health? Yes. Am I praying for his salvation? Without apology. Am I praying because it'll make me feel better? No. But if Christopher Hitchens right now thinks that's why I'm praying, then so be it. I'm still going to pray. We've been covering the news story about Stephen Hawking and his book, The Grand Design, that has attracted so much attention because of his denial of God as creator. In the aftermath of that controversy, Lawrence Krauss has written an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Krauss, who is a cosmologist himself, is director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. In this column entitled Our Spontaneous Universe, Mr. Krauss, looking at the controversy over Stephen Hawking, says, "As a scientist, I have never quite understood the conviction at the basis of essentially all the world's religions, that creation requires a creator." He goes on to suggest that the universe, just as Stephen Hawking has suggested, has appeared by spontaneous emergence, the spontaneous appearance of a universe. He suggests that it's simply a fact, and we had better reconcile ourselves to it. Well, Mr. Krauss, you may be surprised by the controversy, but you'll probably be even more surprised by the fact that very few human beings looking at this universe can come to the assumption that it just happened spontaneously. The New York Times has one of those articles that catches your attention because, well, it tells us something about ourselves and about the changing roles of men and women. Andrew Adam Newman, writing in the New York Times in an article about men's cosmetics, suggests that it has become a bull market, that in fact, a good number of men are raiding their wives' cosmetics drawer. By the way, the wives in retaliation are beginning to buy their husbands their own cosmetics. Cosmetics like eyeliner, like salves and ointments that are to reduce wrinkles, like clearing agents and things to cover scars. Now, Mr. Newman writes in the New York Times that men and women wear cosmetics for different reasons. Women, in order to make themselves more beautiful. Men, in order to cover cosmetic flaws. Whatever the case, there's something strange going on when the New York Times runs an article about a new market, indeed a bull market, for men wearing cosmetics, including cover powder that comes in a compact. I don't think so. But that tells us something about the changing world of men and women out there. It has the attention of the marketers who are now going to be marketing cosmetics to men. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You will find this program, my weekly program, Thinking in Public, and a host of other resources at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. In November, Southern Seminary will host the W Conference, designed to help women think biblically about what it means to be a woman in a complicated world. The conference will be held November 19 through 20, 2010. For more information, visit sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.